Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
So, Southern Cross is back up and running for this year, and with me in studio we've got Pacific Media Centre Director Professor David Roby and our new Pacific Media Watch contributing editor Sri Krishnamurthy. Hello, hello both.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Great to be here.
Great. So yeah, they will be talking about the latest happenings in the Asia Pacific region. But first up, we've got a track from the famous Black Brothers musicians who were exiles from West Papua living in Vanuatu. This is a bit of Lick Lick Hop Tussle, Little Hope at All, in memory of Andy Ayamasiba, who died last week. Lovely song. So David, this is quite sad news for the West Papuan and all those who support the independence then.
Oh yeah, I mean Andy was just an amazing character, and those from West Papua lived so much of his life in Vanuatu. He and the rest of the Black Brothers got kicked out by Indonesia, expelled because they were regarded as subversives. That was about way back in 1980. And they, first of all, they went to the Netherlands, and then in 1983 they managed to go to Vanuatu, and that's where I met them. Andy and the rest of the Black Brothers. There was this Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific conference in Port Vila that year, and so they were a star attraction. But when they actually arrived in Vanuatu, they were treated like heroes by the newly independent government of Vanuatu, headed by Father Walter Lini. You know, they were just treated as heroes in that first government. And Walter and the rest of his family, one of his brothers was later prime minister as well, have been very, very strongly for independence for West Papua. It's quite nostalgic when you just hear that track. But yeah. Basically, it's Andy, something of his life, you know, and he was sort of reminiscing about the Morning Star flag, which is their symbolic flag. It's banned in Indonesia. But also the symbol of the Morning Star is so evocative for them. But one of the editors-in-chief of the Vanuatu Daily Post, Dan McGarry, and he's had his own troubles as well. He was forced out of the country just last year. Mm-hmm. But he wrote a really nice evocative piece marking the passing of Andy last week. And he said that, Andy, he aged gracefully. Encroaching frailty complemented his unassuming, soft-spoken manner, but it masked a dynamism and fervour only visible to his trusted friends and confidants. Once lit, however, that spark provided a glimpse of the man as he was, the jazz-funk rebel walking in his exile hand in hand with equally youthful and equally naive leaders, Today, they refined the Melanesian identity. But it's really sad because he devoted his life hoping that one day he'll be going back to an independent West Papua. Sadly, he never made it. But hopefully, the others of the Black Brothers have passed away, the drummer a couple of years ago now, but hopefully some of the others will realise an independent West Papua one day.
Yeah, so could you tell me a little bit about Andy, a bit more, like what kind of things did he get up to during his life, and what kind of legacy does he leave behind?
Well, his legacy, apart from his music, of course, everybody knows about his music in the Pacific. The Black Brothers were probably one of the most famous groups in all those years, 20, 30 years or so. But he was also an independence advocate, and so he was one of the key people involved in getting the West Papuans recognised in the Melanesian Spearhead Group, which is the political grouping. And so he's left a real strong legacy from that.
And my final question on West Papua is kind of recently what's been happening, because I think last year there were, especially around the independence date, there's quite a lot of things happening, issues rising, and so 2020 again this year, what's kind of any recent updates?
Yes, well, I mean, you're right, Sherry, that there's all those protests that happened through August, September, when some students were attacked in Surabaya by Indonesian students claiming that they were not respecting Indonesian independence. There was a big clash, and the police came and they raided a Papuan dormitory in Surabaya, arrested all the Papuans, but not the Indonesian students who caused it. The students, the Papuan students, felt they were really insulted and so on. So it led to riots right across West Papua, and some administrative buildings were burnt down, etc. But the independence struggle is still very, very strong.
Still
and
ongoing,
very alive.
Most likely,
yes,
yeah.
It'll be ongoing, I think, until independence is realised. And I think that really the authorities in Jakarta have to realise that this is the reality, that the Melanesian people of West Papua want their independence, and some constructive process really has to go ahead to allow that to eventuate.
Definitely an area to keep an eye on and keep following. And then next, Sri, our Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern visited your homeland in Fiji on her Pacific mini tour last week, and it was her first visit since 2016. So how significant was the visit from Jacinda, and how is Fiji doing these days?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting because she was really, really well received in Fiji, and that's also because Frank Bainimarama is started by her child, Neve, and he always wants to see pictures of her. But she was really well received, and you might as well play the queen, okay? I mean, that's how popular she was. And she gave $20 million for relocation of villages affected by climate change and rising sea levels, which is a significant
issue, yeah. Yeah.
And also she visited the Jama'i Masjid Mosque in Lautoga to pay homage to the March 15 tragedy last year.
Yeah. So I've got a piece that you sent over here, in which that three Fijians died last year in the Christchurch terrorist attacks. And so how has Fiji been doing?
Yeah, it's Fiji's doing okay. I mean, politically, it's still not stable. I don't think so. I mean, that is a given, but it's going to take some time for it to come down. And also, it's just been announced that the Fijian government is going to do some work on remitigating the effects of climate change, and that money is going to be announced in the budget.
Okay, that'll be very, very exciting.
Yes.
Positive. I think climate change, refugees, is something that is a pressing concern and needs to be taken, I think, more seriously.
Yeah, it does. I mean, there's up to 15 villages in Fiji right now that are being affected by sea level rises. And that's terrible. I mean, when you think about it, you've got to relocate all those people and relocate the villages inland.
Definitely. And looking on to the new year, what are you thinking in terms of the political situation with Fiji? Do you have any thoughts on it? Or
I don't see too many changes, unfortunately, while the current government is in charge, and Bainimarama is in charge. And it's it's like growing pains. They have to go through it all over again. For the since the first coup in 1987, where the country was doing really well, and now they're taken back. It takes them back about 25 years, and so they're going through growing pains again.
Yeah. So what are some of the most prominent issues that are occurring at the moment?
Prominent issues. I mean, that's, well, climate change is one of them, because Frank Bainimarama is the champion for climate change in the region, and politically, it's every day you hear something new. It's like New Zealand, and the muck gets raked all over the time.
Yeah, so it's definitely also something that to keep an eye on for the rest of the year in terms of Fiji and climate change. And then also, David, there was a bit of controversy over the weekend over the banner headline in the Weekend Herald, which said pandemonium over the first case of the coronavirus. And so the PMC's Asia Pacific report also carried quite a bit about it. What's your take on it?
Well, Sherry, it was quite astounding that actually the major newspaper, daily newspaper in this country, the Weekend Edition, should run this banner headline right across pandemonium. For a start, it wasn't justified even by the story itself, and it just seemed to be scaremongering. And at a time like this is the last thing we need is sort of sowing panic and so on. In fact, it coincided with a message from the head of WHO saying that you really don't get carried away with misinformation and panic hysteria and this sort of thing. So it got quite a bit of flack from many, particularly in the media circles. Various online social media, Kiwi Journalists Association, for example, has a Facebook page and so on. So there was a lot of discussion saying this really is irresponsible. It's, tabloid journalism at its worst and so on. And
the Herald's gone a bit of flack recently with a lot of its kind of headlines. There was the video that wasn't fact checked, that they said was from Wuhan, but was actually from an island that was unrelated, who was eating bats, and they had a lot of misinformation. So I think there's something there.
Even with this edition of the Weekend Herald, they had this big photograph of a person in protective overalls, spraying the surroundings and sort of thing. And so with a headline like that, pandemonium, and a sense that it's panic buying in the shops, which is really wasn't really the case at all. But anyway, it gave the impression, well, this is New Zealand, but in fact it was a photograph from Tehran. It did say that in the caption, but most people, you get a visual impression from the large headline and
when people are in hysterics, they're not going to read the tiny little caption at the bottom.
Then there was a business section in the paper as well that alluded to World War V, where the five came in. Anyway, but in fact, the story was actually quite sober and quite a good account of the economic repercussions and that sort of thing. So where this sensational headline, must have been the same person who wrote the headline for the front page, just completely over the top. But I read this comment from on one of the social media things from a guy called Crispin Maslog. He's sort of like the doyen of communications research and studies in the Philippines, and he just made this curt little comment. And so while everybody's sort of talking about the academics and is it a pandemic, or it's about to become a pandemic or whatever, but he said, look, really, the thing to really worry about is the infodemic.
Yeah, no, definitely. The thing that terrifies me more is definitely the spread of hysteria. My mum called me yesterday, and she's like, everyone's like, countdown, the car parks are full. Should I be worried? Like, should I be buying things? And so I guess the question is, should people be acting like this way? Because no, it's Yeah.
Live a normal life.
There's a huge run in toilet paper.
Yeah? Toilet paper?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Okay, so I've just moved into my new flat. I haven't done the flat shopping, and we were going to go buy some rice tonight, but it looks like... yeah, no, definitely it's a... I guess today with the start of uni as well, right? I've gotten some people message me saying... there's a lot of, I guess, xenophobia and racism that's developed as well with this whole thing, and a lot of hostility towards international students.
Yeah.
So what would you say to people who are, I guess, unsure how to be a good human being, and because I completely understand that people are scared and nervous and freaked out, but what is a reasonable response to all this?
Well, I think that the media itself should actually be, being a lot more welcoming and mm-hmm. so on, and basically sort of trying to get people to react in normal ways, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of statistics show that actually this is extreme responses that are coming through the facts are not really brought out by their sensation, that sort of thing. So the media should really have a responsibility to just be a lot more welcoming and friendly and so on, and yeah. set a tone.
I agree, and don't set the tone for everyone to go raid Countdown. That's just not the tone.
Anyway, the panic buying was over yesterday.
Yes.
Because all the doors were open, back and safe. And the people who are doing shopping normally.
Hopefully there's still some groceries left, eh?
they stock the shelves while you're shopping.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. And also, on a slightly different topic, but also it's lovely to meet you, Shree, and I'm very excited to work with you for the rest of the year. But you had a really perceptive article in the Asia Pacific Report last week that talked about the reality of life after a stroke, and it was also the most read article of the week. Do you mind telling me a little bit about the experience?
It happened on November 2, 2016, when I was traveling between Chennai and Bangalore. And first my mother and brother thought I'd had an hypo, which is I'm a diabetic, which means low sugar. Well, it wasn't a hypo.
Yeah.
And immediately they realized something was wrong. The first thing you do is you hear a sound in your ear, a humming sound, but it's not the same for everyone. I must make that clear. And then your body tightens up in a vice-like grip.
Mm.
And then you lose all sense of your mental faculties. It's really difficult because you lose about 2 million brain cells a minute. And that is really a damaging thing indeed. You go on and you think about what you're already going to do. Like counting backwards from 10 was a really difficult thing for me to do initially.
Mm.
And even things like that. And even words as a journalist, which used to flow in a torrent, come into a trickle. And so you play mind games around, because around a stroke, you have to learn new tricks. And what you do is you learn how to word associate with pictures or images. Right the way through, and it's the worst thing is your brain. Mm. You've got to get your brain working.
Yeah.
Or you can give up, or you can just go off into die. Well, I mean, go off into the wilderness, so to speak. It's a really scary thing.
Yeah.
And it's a very debilitating thing for anybody who's had a stroke, whether a mild stroke or whether any stroke.
Mm.
And for me, losing my brain power was the worst thing. It wasn't so much losing my arm, because I went back to university and I said to Dr. Gudrun Frommer, who's a lecturer in communications, mm-hmm. and I said to her, well, I can't type, I can't write. She said, how do I take notes? And she said, well, you can just use a computer, and that's going to be good enough. But at the same time, AUT was very good in providing me a note taker.
Mm-hmm.
And giving me some software to use for transcription services,
yeah.
And it was that was my savior for the last 2 years, and it got me back to rehabilitation. It got me back to the state that I am in now, where I can talk and do things freely. When people ask me, "How do you feel now?" I just always reply, "As good as I can be."
Mm-hmm. I think it's just massive respect and the strength as well, because I think the brain is always the biggest help, but also the biggest enemy sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And how have you found working in journalism now?
With David?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Any thoughts on?
Excellent. David sent me to Fiji to cover the elections, even though he knew that I had a stroke. So he sent me to Fiji in 2018 twice to cover the elections.
All expenses paid. Trip?
Sort of.
Yes. Yeah, so that's exciting. I'm excited to work with you for the rest of the year, and
and that was a real confidence builder.
Yeah, I think it's very Nice one, David. Nice one, Shree. Great. Well, and so you've just started on the job this week. And so what are some of the stories that the Pacific Media Watch is working on at the moment?
Well, I mean, definitely we're going to be doing something on the coronavirus in the Pacific Islands.
I think that was something that was talked about a lot in terms of New Zealand having such strict borders is the worry and the concern that it would affect the Pacific Islands.
Because especially given that they had an epidemic of measles in Samoa,
just so recent.
We've got to be very, very careful. And the Pacific Islands have got to be very, very careful. Mm. That's a key thing.
Yeah. And other than that, any other stories as well that we're excited for? How about you, David? Any issues that you're excited to cover in 2020?
Oh, well, we're covering a lot of things, you know, and so on, but I'm leaving the Pacific Media Watch role very much to Shree, who has come up with some really good stories over the last few months, so I'm expecting some big things. So.
Great, amazing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to be covering West Papua as well as Australia, because the Australian media laws are becoming very stringent.
Yes.
and they're turning into police states slowly but surely.
When it came out. Great. Well, we'll be back next week with Shree from the Pacific Media Watch Centre, and you can also get updates from them at asiapacificreport.nz.
That was the Southern Cross.